Welcome back to Clinician's Brief, the podcast, the conversations behind the content. I'm your host, registered veterinary technician, Becky Mosser, and we're here in Reno, Nevada for the Wild West Vet Show. We're sitting down with some of these amazing speakers we have out here at the conference to get the inside track on all of the tips and tricks that you can take home and put in practice immediately. If you didn't have a chance to come out to Wild West this year, please make sure that you do next year. We have got tons of great content, amazing speakers, and I'm really excited because I get to sit down for a little bit today and talk with Miss Darcy Palmer, one of my favorite licensed veterinary technicians in VTS and anesthesia. Before we get into all of that, first of all, thank you for being here. I'm excited.
Thank you for having me.
I can't wait to talk to you about your lectures here. It's not over yet, managing anesthesia recovery. I think this is incredibly important. But before that, just tell us a little bit about yourself. How long you've been a tech? Where are you from?
Oh my goodness. Okay. Well, I have been a credentialed technician since 2000. I obtained my VTS in anesthesia in 2006. And right now I live in Auburn, Alabama. So I'm a transplant there. I'm originally from Washington State. And right now I have, my whole career, I have spent in university teaching hospital. And in 2017, I was looking for a change. And so I found a perfect one boarded surgeon practice. His wife is a GP, works out of the same hospital, and I absolutely love it.
Oh,
so
yeah.
It is all about the work-life balance at this point, and that has given me time to be with my kids more, be available for their sports activities, and I still get to do what I love. I get to do anesthesia all day, every day.
It's important to say that because, you know, we talk about you have to find your happiness. It's not going to come find you, and so you have to make those hard decisions, and
absolutely.
Sometimes it's finding that right clinic, that right space for you, but it makes hard choices, right?
Yes.
But
the
work-life balance, it's worth it because we can't pour from an empty cup.
Absolutely.
I say it all the time, and I'm glad that you do that. Again, it's inspirational. We need more people in the industry that are willing to say, look, I'm prioritizing my happiness, my life, and my longevity, because without that, we're not going to be good at what we do.
Exactly.
You know, and speaking of good at what we do, I know you are one of the best at what you do, and I was so excited to have this conversation. I don't get a whole lot of opportunity to talk with technicians here on the podcast because with Clinician's Brief, the majority of the content is written by veterinarians. But when we come out to these conferences, I get to talk to my peeps, sit down with my peeps. And the truth of the matter is you guys have a lot of great knowledge to drop. And veterinarians need to hear it. Support staff need to hear it. And what you're talking about, I think, is really important. And I was grateful for it because when it comes to anesthesia recovery, I think it can be an area that gets a little bit complacent sometimes,
sure.
Maybe too often. And I don't think intentionally. And, you know, despite, you know, I had this like deeply seated fear of recovery put into me in school. Like they put the fear of God and said, if you're going to lose your patient, this is as good a time as any. It's not over. They've got to be up.
Sure.
So despite that, I still sometimes feel like we are not paying as much attention as we could in recovery. Out of curiosity though, with this, are there studies to back up that this is the most dangerous time of anesthesia?
There are. There are actually several mortality studies, but the big main one that really drives home the point is it's a study that is called the SEPSAF study, or the Confidential Inquiry into Perioperative Small Animal Fatalities. This was a published paper in the Veterinary Anesthesia and Analgesia Journal in 2008 by Dr. Broadbelt. So it's a little bit of an outdated paper now. However, the amount of data that they collected, there were 117 hospitals that participated in data collection over a two-year period of time. And during that time, they collected data on almost 100,000 dogs, almost 80,000 cats, and just over 8,000 rabbits.
Wow.
And what this study identified, it identified several risk associated with anesthesia. But what the main point was is that the recovery period is the most likely time for animals to die. Almost 50% of dogs died in recovery, and over 60% of cats and rabbits died in recovery. So this study was monumental in showing us that we need to do a much better job at watching and monitoring our patients during that recovery period.
Is it because they're more at risk at that time, or because we're not watching it close? Like, do we know why we're losing them?
Well, and that's kind of up for grabs. And you would hope that 11 years after this study came out that we have improved in our ways that we are monitoring and watching our patients. But, you know, if you go out in private practice, sometimes we're still seeing animals that are recovered on the floor. No one's paying attention to them because they're so busy trying to get the next case going. And so what is causing it we're not sure. But what this study showed us is that we have to be doing a much better job. And so I think writing protocols and talking about the proper things that should be done, hopefully, are going to be things that practices will pick up on and start implementing into their practice for recovery. One of the things that that study showed was that the 3 hours after the procedure ends or the anesthesia is discontinued is the most likely time for that patient to die. So it identified a time period where we have to just watch those patients very, very closely.
3 hours.
3 hours. That's what the study showed, yes.
But I feel like 3 hours after anesthesia stops, I feel like by 3 hours after anesthesia, those guys are up and walking around then, aren't they? I mean, how are we losing them that far out?
I think it depends on the procedure, but certainly an otherwise healthy patient that is in for an elective spay or neuter, these guys can be pretty high risk. If we do the procedure and we extubate them and put them in a kennel and then they're never looked at again until they're getting ready to go home with the client that afternoon, that is a huge amount of time where that patient is left alone, not monitored. And I think the big kicker is that when our patients are on 100% oxygen, the chance that hypoxemia is going to be a root cause of a problem is pretty insignificant because they're on supplemental oxygen. Well, as soon as we put our patients on room air, it becomes an issue quite quickly. And so a patient that is laying there in the cage and is not breathing can quickly become hypercapnic and hypoxic. And if they're not watched and then immediately supplemented oxygen, they can go into respiratory arrest.
Yeah, I mean, like, we know it's only 22% oxygen or something in room air, and that mm-hmm. it only takes a few, you know, degrees of change in not getting that oxygen level, like yep. just a little bit more nitrogen to like change that absorption level. And so it really isn't just a matter of not getting pure oxygen, but it can be the smallest variabilities, huh?
Yes, for sure. And I think that, you know, when our patients are on supplemental oxygen, the time frame that adverse events occur is prolonged because you've got that extra percentage of oxygen in the lungs. Whereas on 21% oxygen in room air, dilution of oxygen happens very quickly. And so,
was there actual determination of cause of death in this study? Do we know what they're actually dying from?
You know, I would have to go back and look. That is something that I didn't come prepared with that data. But I do think that there is some information in that study that points to the exact reasons, but I am not savvy to that.
Yeah, no, and that's fair, because I just threw that at you. But I just get curious, because I wonder, like, if we know the cause, can we decide how we could do it better? But either way, the doing it better is the monitoring, right?
Sure.
Either way is
Absolutely.
Keeping our eyes on the patient.
Correct.
Yeah, and that's what we have to do. So, okay, talk to me a little bit about, you know, the anesthesia team in general. Like, clinics everywhere are short on staff. I mean,
sure.
we don't have enough staff, and they're struggling to fill open positions, let alone just schedules where people need a little bit of life, you know? But I feel like too often there's not enough people involved in the surgery team. There's not enough eyes in that room.
Yeah, I would definitely agree with that. And so I would say under an ideal condition, you have got a person that is 100% dedicated to anesthesia, and then you've got people that are dedicated to the surgical process. So from an anesthesia standpoint, that technician should be involved with the DVM of developing the protocol. They should be involved with setting up the equipment, making sure the anesthesia machine is ready to go, have all of the supplies for induction and intubation ready. That anesthesia tech will then induce and intubate the patient, get them all hooked up to the monitoring equipment, and then start the recording process of the anesthesia record. Keeping track of what happens during the anesthetic event is so important because we have to have a record of the events so that we know if we need to intervene or not. So all of that stuff that you're doing seems like it's very easy to do, but when you've got a patient in front of you, it can take 10 to 15 minutes from the time that you induce them to the time that you are caught up with your record and you're starting to just monitor them. So ideally, an anesthesia person should be dedicated to that process, but then the surgical team can be working on the patient and getting them ready for the procedure so that there's no delay. So clipping and prepping the patient, doing the surgical scrub, the sterile scrub, and positioning them on the table and getting them ready for the surgeon to come in. A lot of technicians are trained to properly drape in a patient, so the surgeon doesn't actually have to come into the OR until he's ready to just grab the scalpel and start the incision. So having dedicated people like that, I think helps with efficiency more than people realize. If you just had one person in charge of doing the anesthesia and the surgery aspect of it, it's going to take longer, but then you also have a period of time where that patient is not being monitored closely, and that is another area where things can go wrong because that technician is so dedicated to setting up the surgery table, getting the patient prepped, they're not watching the monitored parameters. So that's when bad things can happen.
Yeah, and I feel like that can be the norm. And to your point about the monitored parameters, then how, like, what's the best case scenario there? How long should we be monitoring those parameters outside of removal from anesthetic gases and in recovery stages? How long are we charting that?
Sure. So I recommend that the vital signs be recorded every 5 minutes on the anesthesia record until that patient is extubated. Now, the amount of monitoring equipment that is left on them kind of depends on the patient's status. But for me, I like to keep the capnograph, the pulse oximeter, and the Doppler attached to the patient while they are still intubated. So you can easily assess ventilation and oxygenation at that time with the capnograph and the pulse oximeter. One of the nice things is that you can discontinue the oxygen while they're still intubated, and then you're using your monitoring tools, the capnograph and the pulse oximeter, to assess how they are able to oxygenate and ventilate on room air. I like to leave the Doppler attached to them because that gives me an audible sound of the heart beating of you know, blood flow.
Yeah.
But that just frees up my hands. I don't have to have a stethoscope and use it to auscultate the chest. I can use the Doppler and I'm hearing the heart beating. And then if the patient had any kind of arrhythmias during the procedure, I think it would be important to continue monitoring the ECG through recovery as well. Some of those cardiac patients go on to have continuous ECG monitoring through telemetry in the post-op period. So that kind of depends on the individual patient's status. But then temperature is also an extremely important parameter to monitor. So we will record temperature as soon as we discontinue the inhalant. And if they're hypothermic, you want to provide them with a heat source until they become normal thermic. So I will record the initial temperature at discontinuation of the inhalant. And then if they were hypothermic, I will continue to provide a heat source. And then once they become normal thermic, I'll write that time down and the temperature on the anesthesia record. So if they are hypothermic, the temperature should continue to be monitored at least every 20 to 30 minutes while a heat source is being supplied. And then it's really important to challenge them. So once they become normal thermic, remove that heat source from them, but come back an hour later and take their temperature and make sure that they're able to maintain their body temperature on their own. And a lot of the times what we find is that within that hour period of no heat supply, they go back down to a hypothermic state. So continuing to monitor the body temperature, making sure that they are able to regulate it on their own. Those are all important things that need to be done in recovery.
Okay, tell me, define recovery. When is your patient recovered?
So a full recovery would be defined as the point that the patient can sit sternal as long as their condition allows, and all of their vital signs are within normal limits. And I'd even go as far as say, for an otherwise normal, healthy patient beforehand, those patients should be mentally appropriate. They should, you know, pretty much be like they were prior to coming into the clinic for whatever procedure.
So funny you say, I can't think about, I think so often how much I hear, oh, we're still drunk, you know, while we're like trying to get out of the clinic, trying to go home. And I think about how often we cater to our clients' convenience factor.
Yes.
Like, I got to pick my kids up. Is there any way I can come get them at 3 because 5 is a little too late? And it scares me a little bit sometimes when I see the condition that some of our pets go out of the clinic. And I think this is another area where maybe with cats we're being extra negligent because they are kind of hunkered down. Their mentation maybe isn't full, like they're hiding anyway. They're miserable.
Sure.
We've really violated them in some way, right? And they're mad at us. And so they are like these tiny little angry balls in the corner, and there isn't really actually a lot of normal movement or, you know, but we kind of want to leave them alone and not stress them out. I think we might be sending them home too early.
Certainly. And I think that, you know, like those signs that you just described, to me, that means that that patient is painful.
Yeah.
And so I do think you're exactly right. Like, do these patients need to stay overnight so that
yeah.
we can continue providing them with proper analgesia intravenously until they have made a full recovery so that when they go home with their owner, they are normal?
regardless of how inconvenient the client finds it.
Sure.
I guess I just get frustrated sometimes that I feel like a client can just moan and groan their way into getting a patient home early, and I'm like, but this was a surgical incision. Like, I feel like you definitely need to spend the night, and people truly, we have to set that expectation up right ahead of time, and I know I'm going down a rabbit hole, but I think it's important to keep in mind and to take very, very seriously. And, you know, I think you're right, until they're absolutely normal. So if we still think they're drunk, they shouldn't be going home, right?
I agree with that, yes.
So I love this discussion about rocky recovery as well. So within your presentation, you talk about these rocky recoveries. And I think a lot of folks out there think that dysphoric recoveries are just how it goes, right? This vocalization and flailing and stuff. There's two points I kind of want to focus. So first of all, help us distinguish pain from dysphoria.
Okay, so there's actually three ways to categorize a rough recovery. You have pain, emergence delirium, and dysphoria. And so a lot of times a patient, so let me back up and define a rough recovery. So a rough recovery is a patient that as soon as they are extubated, they are vocalizing, they may be thrashing, paddling their limbs, they may be agitated, trying to get up, and they're just overall disoriented from their surroundings. So a lot of times, one of the most common misconceptions that I see is that people immediately label a patient as dysphoric just because they're vocal. Well, a painful patient and a patient experiencing emergence delirium can also be vocal. So vocalization alone is not a way to absolutely define the cause of the rough recovery. So some ways that we can differentiate between those: a painful patient will usually calm down and relax after an analgesic agent like an opioid has been administered. They also are responsive to human interaction. So talking softly to them, sitting with them in the cage, gently restraining them on a gurney, all of those ways will help the patient calm down. And then pain is pretty easy to identify in a truly painful patient. So if you palpate right around that surgical incision, they're going to respond to you. Whereas if you palpate anywhere else on their body, they're likely not going to respond. The next, emergence delirium. This is primarily caused from lack of sedation at the time of recovery. And so once that patient is extubated, if there's no sedation on board, these guys, they may or may not be vocal, but they are definitely thrashing around, paddling their legs, and overall disoriented. Usually, a patient that is experiencing emergence delirium will calm down with a dose of sedative. A truly dysphoric patient, so the definition of dysphoria from an anesthesia standpoint is administering excessively large doses of opioids to patients that may not be that painful. So dysphoria doesn't really happen right in the immediate recovery period or right after extubation, because we have to rule out pain and emergence delirium first. So dysphoria is one of those things where we're going to classify it as dysphoria several hours out from the procedure. But how we classify a dysphoric patient is that, one, they are not responding to that initial dose of opioid or that initial dose of sedation. A truly dysphoric patient isn't going to respond to human interaction at all. So you can talk to them, you can sit in their cage, and they're going to act like you're not even around. And then the source of pain is pretty difficult to identify in a truly dysphoric patient. So if you touch the incision, they're going to respond. If you touch anywhere else on their body, they're going to be hypersensitive to them just being touched. And so you're not going to be able to differentiate a non-painful spot from a painful spot with a dysphoric dog.
So when we're getting into these situations with dysphoria, I mean, what can we do to improve the situations? Is it a protocol situation? Is it a patient situation? What do we really need to look at outside of just maybe, obviously, if it's happening to all of our recovery patients, right?
Sure. And I think we'll get into that in a minute if it is happening to all of your patients at one time. But I think when a rough recovery occurs, it's going to be impossible to rule out pain and emergence delirium without treating those first. And so the first step should be administering the opioid, seeing what response you get. if that helps, but maybe it's not enough, then add in a sedative agent. The most common sedative agents that we use are acepromazine and dexmedetomidine. And the really cool thing is that if a patient is experiencing emergence delirium, a microdose of acepromazine or dexmedetomidine is usually all that is needed in combination with that opioid to calm the patient down, relax them, and help them come to a more conscious state. So microdoses, right? So you don't even have to use a full systemic dose. So you don't have to completely knock the patient back out. You're just giving them a little bit of a sedative agent to take the edge off and allow them to come into a more proper state of consciousness.
What I like that you just said there is the microdose to help bring them to a more conscious state, which feels counterintuitive, right? If we're giving a sedative, we're thinking, well, we just need to get them through this. They just need to wake up and get through it. But we actually don't, right? I just kind of want to elaborate on that.
Correct. Yeah, it's just it's just enough to take the edge off of them. And that microdose is usually all that is needed to calm them down, stop them from vocalizing, stop them from thrashing around. And they just take another 10, 20 minutes to kind of come through the conscious state of getting the inhalant out of their system and being more mentally appropriate.
How much of this is because we're bugging them to wake up? How much of the thumping and the esophageal tube moving and the come on, buddy, you see it so much and we really shouldn't be doing this, right?
Correct. No, that stimulating, premature stimulation of a patient to just to get them to extubate quicker can actually have pretty grave consequences, because if they are not mentally appropriate enough to maintain ventilation on their own, then you get right back into that situation where, okay, you've got them awake enough to extubate them because you've been beating on their chest or trying to stimulate them in whatever way. But then as soon as you extubate them, put them in a kennel, they're going to fall back asleep. And if that patient is not ready to properly ventilate on their own, if they go apneic, then that's the opportunity where oxygenation is going to drop. Your CO2 levels are going to go high. When you're on supplemental oxygen, that CO2 can very easily dilute out the oxygen in the lungs, leading to hypoxemia. And they can just silently go into respiratory arrest. So prematurely trying to stimulate a patient to get them extubated can have grave consequences.
Yeah, and I think we see it all the time. And I think for some, with lack of experience, because I know it does come with time, I see people get really worried because they're scared they're going to bite through the tube. They're scared that as they're kind of coming up and movement starts to occur, having this tube, and they become worried about that tube so much. Talk a little bit about that safety. Are we okay? What can we allow?
Okay. So I have, and I think this is just me developing a technique over the years that I've been doing this, but most of our dogs and cats can recover in lateral recumbency. And so I stand behind them and then I put my arm across their neck. And I will untie the endotracheal tube and I use a mouth gag. So I use just a roll of white tape and I put that between their teeth. And I hold their tongue out to the side of their mouth with the same arm that I have control of their head over. So in the event that a patient wakes up quickly, I've not only got control of their head, but I also have their tongue. And I have yet to meet a patient that will bite down on their own tongue within the couple seconds that it takes me to deflate the cuff and extubate the tube before any adverse event happens, like them biting the tube. So having that control of their head is everything. And then of course, having some team personnel around to, if you see that that patient suddenly has come central in the eyes and stretched out and you know that this patient's about ready to jump off the table, call for help. There should be people around that clinic that can come in and help restrain that patient so that you can safely get them extubated and then deal with the rough recovery at that time.
We're going to call it the Darcy Palmer methodology of recovery. It's going to be published in journals. The one-handed tongue hold method. Yeah, but to that point, an animal can sit sternal, completely upright, move all around and be not even kind of consciously awake in doing that. And that doesn't mean we're pulling that tube immediately, right? Give them a second. It's scary. I get it. He's sitting up. There's a tube hanging out of the mouth, right? We're like, oh, they're awake. A split second later, they're laid right back down and sleeping. We really have to know they're recovered, right? For their own personal safety.
Yes. And I think if you have a lot of patients that are taking a long time to extubate after procedure, then it's time to reevaluate your anesthetic drug protocol. What are you doing that is causing recovery to be so prolonged? And a lot of the times, if I had to take an educated guess, I'd say that it's the inhalant concentration that is kept so high. And that is, as soon as that's turned off, it takes a patient a while to breathe that out and get that inhalant out of their system so that they can recover. So, you know, I do a lot of orthopedic procedures now, and our patients are extubated within 5, maybe 10 minutes off the inhalant. And that's with taking post-op radiographs. So we take them right from the surgery table into radiology to take those radiographs, and very rarely do I have a patient come back to me still intubated. So they're either extubated on the surgery table as we're getting them all unhooked from everything, or they extubate during the RADS.
That's important, and that makes a lot of sense. And in addition to that, what are the other common misconceptions you're seeing around anesthetic recovery?
I think the main misconception is just that nothing can go wrong, because that couldn't be further from the truth. I mean, the recovery is definitely that time period where if you ignore that patient, something's going to go wrong. So a lot of people say that induction is the most critical time for anesthesia, but I would be willing to bet that you could say, yes, induction is stressful and has the potential for causing issue, but the recovery period is just as important, if not more important, than the induction.
Sure, and I feel like in an induction, there's all hands on deck. So, you know, there's eyes, there's hands, there's equipment. And in that recovery period, you know, I think about so many dogs that are just sleeping all nestled in their cages, tucked up. We can barely, like, if those dogs actually went into cardiac arrest, I bet that we wouldn't know in any kind of time. If you're already reading Clinician's Brief, why not get credit for it? Get affordable, race-approved CE from Clinician's Brief content you trust without leaving your desk. You can track your earned hours, receipts, and certificates and see the latest available courses at cliniciansbrief.com/CE. Get started today. I guess just kind of, you can summarize a little bit, like, what can we do to be the most proactive in setting our patients up for these smooth recoveries so that the recovery time is quick and is comfortable and we all feel good about it?
Sure. And I think that comes down to simply providing a balanced anesthesia drug protocol. So make sure that you have adequate analgesia and sedation on board. Part of balanced anesthesia is ensuring that you have a multimodal approach to pain management. So yes, the opioids are going to be the foundation analgesic agent that we use, but they shouldn't be the only analgesic agent that we use. Use a multimodal approach. Add in NSAIDs, dexmedetomidine, ketamine, lidocaine. There's a lot of other analgesic agents out there that we can use in combination with the opioids to ensure a multimodal approach. And by utilizing a balanced anesthesia protocol, it ensures that adequate sedation and analgesia are on board for all phases of anesthesia, including recovery. And so one of the things that you should do is, before you turn off the inhalant, evaluate your anesthesia record and note the time that your patient last received a sedative or an analgesic agent. And then you have to have some knowledge about the drugs to know what those durations of actions are and to understand if that time frame has lapsed. So, for example, if I have an otherwise healthy orthopedic patient and let's say I've premedded with hydromorphone and dexmedetomidine, well, I gave those premeds intramuscularly an hour before we induced the patient, and then that TPLO took 4 hours. Well, I'm going to have an epidural on board, and so that epidural, the combination of an opioid and a local anesthetic, is usually enough to provide superior analgesia during the actual procedure. And so I might not have to have had give an additional analgesic or sedative agent during the procedure, but we're now 5 hours out from giving dexmedetomidine and hydromorphone in the premeds. And so in recovery, that patient's going to be recovering without systemic opioids on board and without adequate sedation on board. So I can almost guarantee that that patient is going to have a rough recovery in that instance. So evaluating the anesthesia record and being prepared for a rough recovery will help you be able to treat it as soon as it occurs, and then there's less chance for harm coming to the patient or to us.
And I could go on a real rabbit hole here, but
local blocks and epidurals.
Absolutely.
Like we're screwing up our recovery because we're not using those enough, right? Because we can really ride those guys really light and easy, especially for these long-term procedures where we are worried about the anesthesia. We're underutilizing, and that can really make for a better recovery because they're less painful, right?
Absolutely. And that brings another point is the whole purpose of a balanced anesthesia drug protocol that includes multimodal analgesia is so that it allows you to decrease the inhalant concentration that you're using in your patient. And so by far, out of all of the agents that we use during anesthesia, the inhalants are going to cause the most cardiovascular and respiratory depression. So if we can use a balanced anesthesia approach, then we keep our inhalant concentration low, and that in turn allows our patients to be ready to recover as soon as we turn that inhalant off. And they recover and they're comfortable. So that is a key point. And that's where local anesthetics and local regional blocks really play a nice role.
Use them for everyone.
Absolutely.
Okay, so I'm going to put your feet to the fire here in our Keep It Brief section. But there's not a lot of pressure. We rarely keep it brief.
Okay.
If you had to give a top five summary of the best recovery practices, tell me what they are.
Okay. Well, first, I would absolutely start by utilizing a balanced anesthesia drug protocol. That by far ensuring that proper sedation and analgesia are on board for all phases of anesthesia is hugely important. And I couldn't stress it enough for ensuring that the recovery process is smooth as well. The second thing that I would say is that before you turn off the inhalant, check the oral cavity and make sure that there's not blood, excessive mucus, dental debris, if you did a dental. So anytime that you do a procedure of the head, you should always check the oral cavity before turning them off inhalant. But I think it's important to do that for all patients because not only are you looking for foreign material like gauze, dental debris, that kind of thing, you're also looking for signs of regurgitation. Regurgitation can actually happen at any point during anesthesia, but it oftentimes goes unnoticed because it's not in a high enough volume for clinical signs to be apparent. But if that volume is in a high enough amount, then you'll start to see the clinical signs of like a brownish yellow fluid from their nose or mouth. Well, if you see that, it should be treated before you wake the patient up. And so that's one of the good things that you can, a good practice to get involved with is just inspect that oral cavity and make sure that it is clear before turning off the inhalant. And then three, I recommend leaving the patient on 100% oxygen for at least 3 to 5 minutes after you turn off the inhalant. This is going to do two things. It's going to help dilute out the inhalant, which is going to hasten recovery. And then it's also going to continue scavenging the waste anesthetic gases so that myself is not exposed to an excessive amount of waste anesthetic gas while I'm standing right at that patient's head in recovery. Now, of course, if your patient is ready to extubate within that 3 to 5 minutes, obviously you're going to extubate them. You don't want to delay extubation just to give them oxygen. But that is something that you can do to kind of help the recovery process is provide that oxygen supplement for them if they're still not coming aroused within that 3 to 5 minute time frame. The fourth thing that I would say is that a dedicated person should be with a patient at all times when they are still intubated in recovery. So that means zero distractions, zero multitasking, not looking at their cell phone rather than paying attention to the patient. They need to be 100% dedicated to watching that patient and being prepared to extubate them when they start showing signs of being ready. And then the last thing that I would say is I think it's so important to continue monitoring our patients in recovery. And a lot of times I see people, as soon as the inhalant is turned off, boom, they've taken all the monitoring equipment off and they're just waiting for that patient to extubate. Well, if you don't have anything to look at to tell you how the vital signs are doing, how do you know that patient is okay? So keep that monitoring equipment on them as long as you can, because the more that you are monitoring, the more information you're getting from that patient and the more prepared you will be to determine when that patient has made a full recovery.
Those are all incredible tips. Where do you like to send people for resources if they want to learn more, if they want to work on their protocols? What are your favorite resources for anesthesia and protocols?
Well, I have two. I will say that VSPN has been an amazing resource for me as I started out in my career. They have a ton of opportunities for members. Membership is free, but you have access to message boards, round sessions, a whole library of documents. There's a VSPN notebook, and all of that information comes free with the membership.
So VSPN is a Veterinary Support Personnel Network, right? So
yes.
if people aren't familiar with it, they know that this is for support staff members who can utilize
correct.
This whole entire library wealth of information that is geared toward the support staff, correct?
Correct.
Yeah, because we know the veterinarians are regularly tapping into VIN, but I think a lot of the support staff don't know that they have a resource
too. Don't realize, yes, exactly.
Okay, what else do you like?
And then I'll do a shameless plug here.
Do it.
Because I am an administrator for the Facebook page Veterinary Anesthesia Nerds.
Mm-hmm.
And so that is a group where you can come in, pose a question, ask a question, and get a variety of responses. We've got several anesthesiologists on there. We've got several VTS anesthesia technicians that are on there. And so it's just a great community to ask questions, get questions answered. We do monitor the questions that are given and the information that is provided because we like to ensure that the information that is provided is correct and accurate. So we do a lot of informing and teaching on that page, but you know, it's a great community. We have over 40,000 members right now, so it's huge.
Yeah, it's been really fun to watch the anesthesia nerd community grow, right?
Yeah.
And you're actually leaving here to head out to the symposium.
Yes.
You're right. This information that's a great, I don't care what role you play in the clinic, the veterinary industry Nerds is a huge wealth of knowledge and people who just really, really like to talk anesthesia.
Yes.
I learn a whole lot every time I'm on there. I realize how little I enjoy about talking about anesthesia. But truthfully, I think it's a great place to just kind of do that social networking of, hey, I want to do the best thing. I've seen a lot of just situational things worked through and a really well-developed file section as well. So you can,
yes,
even without getting involved, if you are classic introverts of the veterinary industry, you don't actually want to talk to anyone, you can,
sure,
do a really good search. So I'm glad you brought that up. I think it's a great,
yeah,
resource. This is important stuff. I'm glad you're bringing this up. I think sometimes it is so important to, we think things are quote unquote obvious, but we see that the numbers show us differently, right? They're not,
exactly,
obvious. We're not doing our best practices.
Exactly.
Anesthesia is important. We love it. And we've got to be doing the very best we can by our patients. And again, I think too, it makes us feel better about our jobs and what we're doing, right? If we have patients recovering smooth and nice, not screaming and flailing,
absolutely,
we feel good about our jobs. And that's the most important.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much for taking the time to be
Thank
here
you for
today,
having me. This is
we're
great.
Gonna do this again.
Awesome.
Thanks.
Thanks again to today's guest for joining us, and thanks to you for listening. If you enjoyed today's episode, you can find us wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts. While you're there, make sure you subscribe, rate, and review. We appreciate if you leave us all the stars. You can listen to podcasts as well on our website at cliniciansbrief.com/podcasts. You can find us at facebook.com/cliniciansbrief, on Twitter at cliniciansbrief, and on Instagram at clinicians.brief. You can also drop us a line at podcast@briefmedia.com. Clinicians Brief, the podcast, is a Brief Media production, produced by Alexis Ustry, sound by Randall Stupka, hosted by me, Becky Mosser, with special thanks to production assistant Michelle Monkrez.